Ruth chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, that would be Ruth, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say, I will do. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart." Amen. So we haven't spoken about this at length. The one crucial concept in Israel's culture and of this particular story is that of the kinsman redeemer. If you were an Israelite, you would have grown up with a familiarity with what this is and what this means. If you found yourself in some sort of trouble, a kinsman could step in and save you. Maybe you are laden with debt, and you must sell yourself and your family into bondage or slavery. A kinsman redeemer could come, and they could buy you out of it. Or maybe you had to sell some of your land, presumably like Elimelech in our story. That's what he and Naomi likely had to do, and move to Moab just to have enough livelihood to keep going. Well, your kinsman redeemer could come, and they could buy your land back, restoring to you your home, restoring your livelihood. And even more, if someone had grievously wronged you or grievously wronged your family, the kinsman redeemer had the right to hunt them down and bring them to justice, taking the name, the awesome name, of Blood Avenger. And this redeemer, well, they would have to be a good man, and they would have to be a man who had his affairs in order. After all, they must be wealthy enough to pay the price of redemption, but they also must be a worthy man, someone who would be willing to stick their neck out simply for the sake of their family. If they redeem your property, they are essentially paying the cost of redemption and then handing that property back over to you, not reaping the rewards. If they stand in as a levirate, which means that they provided an heir to a family member upon the loss of a husband, their brother's heir, they could not go back and receive upon themselves the rewards of this heir. This heir would take the name of his father, his blood father. He would take the name and the inheritance and the land and the property of his deceased father, and the kinsman redeemer would not stand to benefit from that son's inheritance. You could simply say that it was for the joy that was set before them that they would take on such a burden. And it's the kind of thing where you would begin to wonder, if you were a child in Israel, who your redeemer might be. Maybe you're at the funeral of a family member. With all your relatives standing around, you might begin to look up and think, which one of these people is going to help me out when I'm in trouble? Where does my help come from? Does a redeemer for me live? This is why, for Job's part, when we are told of his great loss and Job's great despair, he cries out that he knows his redeemer lives. He knows that he will be protected and provided for, even though he doesn't know who it's coming from or how it's going to get there. He knows his Redeemer lives. And by this custom, a person could face troubling times with a sense of rest. And they could know that even if they are coming upon hardship, if famine comes my way, slavery comes my way, injustice comes my way, in the back of their mind, they know, but I have a Redeemer. I have support. I have hope. And therefore, I have rest. And this is the kind of hope, it's the kind of rest that Naomi holds out for Ruth, her daughter-in-law. When she was told the name of the man who had found favor upon Ruth, this Boaz, and how he had lavished her with all of this provision, well, she makes the connection in her mind that this man is how God is going to bless her and her daughter-in-law with rest. That's how God's going to do it. This man is our relative. He's our kinsman, she says. And maybe this man would be willing to be our Redeemer. And it is our Redeemer, by the way. For Boaz would not just be providing for Ruth, but providing for Ruth and Naomi. Now, the desire for protection and rest is completely understandable by all of us in this room. But at the possibility of redemption, what we see in our text this morning is that Naomi tries to secure that rest by taking matters into her own hands. She crafts a plan to get Boaz's attention, and she forces the issue of redemption upon him. Now, being a fair reader of this text, on the one hand, is she wrong for doing this? God is clearly opening a door for them through Boaz. Is she right? Should she be commended for leaning into that door, walking into that opportunity, running through it in the name of God? Or is she, in her excitement at the possibility of redemption, at the excitement of the possibility of hope and rest, and in the fear of her vulnerability, is she plowing ahead too quickly? Is Naomi trying to take hold of this rest that she wants for Ruth and for herself by the wrong means? And that becomes the central question for this text this morning. Is she running ahead in her own strength? So let's take a look back at Naomi's scheme and then Boaz's response to it. It's two things to take a look at this morning. Let's go back and look for just a second at Naomi's scheme and let's just see what exactly is happening there. And then let's notice Boaz's response to it. For Naomi's part, she begins to craft a plan for Ruth. You know, Ruth, tonight, there's going to be this great party down at the threshing floor. The harvest is in. And those guys will take the barley down to the threshing floor, and they'll begin to crush the grain and separate the chaff in the wind, and they'll stack up this whole year's harvest. And there's been a famine. We haven't had a harvest like this in a long time. There's going to be revelry and eating and drinking and singing and dancing, and Boaz is going to be there, Ruth. Why don't you go put on that nice cloak that you have and make sure to add a little bit of my perfume, but go at nighttime. Don't let anyone see you. I want you to slip in real late at night after he's taken his drink, after he's lied down to sleep. I want you to go and uncover his feet, and once he wakes up, well, he'll tell you the rest, and he'll tell you what to do. And in these five verses, pretty suggestive. Now, it's not hard to see that this plan of hers is manipulative, and it's a bit sneaky. Basically, it's, hey, Ruth, go put on that red dress and make yourself available tonight. Because after tonight, according to the law, if this goes the way I'm thinking it's going to go, he's going to be obligated to redeem you. Does that make sense? You catch him at the right time, he's going to be obligated to make this happen for all of us. And we know that she's a bit rebuked for this because later in the text, which is not our text for this morning, but if you'll just look down, Boaz ultimately puts a stop to this plan and he sends Ruth back out before dawn breaks and anyone can see her. And he begins to foil the plan of Naomi. And I think that given Naomi's desire for rest and for security and given her state of vulnerability, looking around at what little food and what future and what hope that she might have, scheming to get security makes a good deal of sense. At least that's how I feel in my own flesh. Scheming to get security is something that I'm pretty familiar with. And this seems to be the dividing line between those who are operating out of fear and those who are operating their lives out of faith. At any given moment in our lives, we are forced to navigate in the present time with an unknown future, future that you can't see, obviously. So faith approaches what it can't see with an assurance of things hoped for. And that means that it is holding on to God and his promises and his character, walking forward through life with open hands. So it's holding on to God, it's holding on to his promises, it's holding on to his character, but it walks through life with open hands. That's what faith looks like. Now, a fear, the same present reality. You can't see what's ahead of you. It's just as mysterious as the person who's living by faith. But a person who lives by fear, they cling on to what it can see. Not with open hands living through life, but with clenched fists on what is right before them, what is right now, what looks like stability, what looks like rest, and they try to take that by force. There's nothing good that comes by living through fear. Now, first, we aren't made to live that way. We aren't to be twitchy and skittish and panicked all the time. Christians, instead, are to be filled with hope and joy and rest and abundant life. Not meant to be living every day, flailing their legs, trying to grab on to whatever floats to stay alive and keep their head above water. We've been transferred out of a kingdom of darkness with its sin and death and fear and loss. We've been transferred into a new life with Christ, where we cannot sink, where he is not distant, and where his perfect love casts out all fear. The second thing, not only are we not meant to live this way, this sort of twitchy, panicked testimony to daily life. We think about a baptism just now, and collectively and as a family of the Hoffers, to live in such a way that doesn't live under God's grace in a twitchy, panicked kind of way that grabs on to any state of security that it can have, but rests and is a life of gratitude and worship, that not a hair on your head can be touched without the say-so of a sovereign God. Stability will preach. And in our world, it still preaches. It preaches very powerfully. Second, fear tempts us to scheme, and it gives our trust to that which is sin. But no rest ever comes of that. Fear triggers a response to cling to what it can see in the temporary, trusting it for security. But not a thing in this world can give you rest that you are hoping for. Not a thing. We spend much of our lives, sadly, testing out this theory, trying again and again and again and again to take rest by our own hands through what is expedient and what looks available, only to find that it is illusory and insufficient and is usually done by means of sin, by scheming and deception. So we've seen this dynamic at play time and again in the scriptures. When Abraham and Sarah were promised an heir, they waited for a little while. Actually, waited for quite a while. But eventually, it was too much. What'd they do? They began to scheme. They still believed that God was going to bless them, but they were going to get it their way and at their timing and at what was convenient for them. They were scared because they were getting older. So Sarah gives Hagar to Abraham and forces the issue, trying to take an heir by force. And isn't that an easy temptation? Right? We simply believe that God, in our vulnerability and in our pressing need, he's taking too long. So, what do? You take matters into your own hands. And you come up with a scheme to get what you want. And we can feel that we are motivated by the right things. Naomi was right to seek rest, but she was seeking it in the wrong way. Peter was right to love Christ, but he wasn't to defend him or his arrest by taking out his sword and slashing at the guards, right? Jesus says, I get it. It's the wrong way. Don't take this into your own hands. That's not how we're going to do this. So you can rationalize all that you want, and you'll be somewhat right. That's the kicker here. You will get a little bit right. If you want rest, you know what? You're right. You need rest. You were designed for rest. Augustine famously said, right, our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And you can tell yourself that this justifies whatever means you might take to get that rest. So you just need the rest of companionship and love, and I just need the rest of physical relief. So you indulge in lust. Take matters into your own hands, right? And get that at your own timing. You need the rest of security. So you buy things that you can't afford. I need that rest of security. I need it now. I need the rest of stability in my life. Significance. So I'm thinking about taking this job. Yes, it's going to pull me away from my community. It's going to pull me away from my church. It's going to take me away from my family. But it's the first thing available, and it makes good money. Not necessarily wrong all the time. But we're faced with this kind of thing all the time. This thing that I need from ultimately God, I can take quickly by myself. And it'll be a mirage to you every time. I need the rest of financial margin. I just need a little space. So I'm not going to give. I'm not going to engage in hospitality. I'm just going to hold that tight to myself. Because that's what I can control. And that good and right desire, that rationalized desire for rest and peace, comes at a cost of your soul, comes at a cost of sin. Like Eve, right? You bite into the fruit and think, that wasn't it. That didn't do it. Interestingly, one last example also serves as a literary shadow to our particular story. Ruth is a Moabite. Where do the Moabites come from? They're descendants of Lot's family. In a horrendous story from Genesis 19, when Lot's daughters didn't have heirs of their own, they waited until their father had taken his drink and that he had fallen asleep. And they uncovered his nakedness. It's almost an exact parallel to our story. And in their fear of childlessness, they took matters into their own hands, and the firstborn from that situation was named Moab, who was the father of the Moabites. So when you get to our story and you get to Ruth and she's faced with a similar thing, is she going to take these matters into her own hands? Is she going to sort of be the master of her own fate, right? The captain of her own soul? How will she respond? Hopefully she stands in contrast to the Moabites and to Naomi. Will Ruth act in faith? Or will she act in fear? With that knee-jerk reaction to clamp down on whatever we can grab? Will she be a true Moabite woman? Or will she be like Naomi, who was of a generation of those who were in Israel who did what was right in their own eyes? Or will Ruth somehow go a different way? Rest is something that we all want. It's something that we all need. But the only suitable source for our security and rest is the Creator, not its creation, not his creation, not his creations. And as you walk through the unknown and the unseen, you must let go of fear, which clings on to false rest givers. and you must give yourself over to God, because he can hold your weight. He can hold your needs. He it is who says, come and drink, and you'll never be thirsty again. It's the kind of thing that rolls off of Jesus' lips that we hear as philosophy, and he speaks as a promise to you. I say to you as a pastor this morning, if you come to Christ and throw yourself for the rest of your souls onto Christ and drink from him, his promise holds true. And you will never be thirsty again. And you can let go of the things of earth. They grow strangely dim in the light of who he is. We are easily persuaded to scheme. We are easily persuaded to take God's sovereignty and help him out a little bit with our scheming. And he needs none of it, and you need none of it. So be free from that. Let's look at Boaz's response. It helps us to see how we can be free of such a thing. Now, we'll cover this a bit in detail next week. It's not really our text for this morning, but it's enough today to simply see what Boaz does. We should note that. Apparently, the whole uncovering his feet thing was a bit of an alarm clock, right? Eventually, he'll get cold enough and start to shiver, and he'll look down. And there's Ruth. And so he does. She's there, and she's dressed in her best robe. She's smelling good. But she doesn't make any moves on Boaz, which is important, something we'll come back to next week. And really, the only two things that you need to take note of at present are these. Number one, Boaz turns down Naomi's scheme. He's a man of Hesed. We have talked about this concept for many, many weeks. We do have a lot of guests. So let me just say it, because it feels like it's the gospel sort of in just this powder keg short phrase. Hesed is this phrase that says, there is love and there is faithfulness and there is loyalty. But Hesed is something different. That's a Hebrew word. Hesed as a concept is that there's a boundary or an obligation that love is required, but Hesed just overflows the boundary. It just overflows it and keeps going and going and going. And the faithfulness and the kindness and the goodness just pours out. It's the kind of thing that God does on the cross, right? We are dead in our trespasses and sins. All of us have turned away from Christ. We are at enmity with God. We are enemies with God. And yet, he still gave his life for us on the cross and poured out everything. He owed us nothing and gave us everything. And that is what is the theme of this book of Ruth. And that is what Boaz is embodying here. He's a man of intense loyalty and a man of deep love. And oh God, that we would be more like that in ourselves. So he turns away Naomi's scheme. And he speaks tenderly to Ruth, and then he sends her home under the cover of night before anyone might notice her. So we do see a direct rebuke of Naomi's plans. And then the second thing you need to notice about Boaz is that he tells Ruth not to fear, and that he will gladly spread his wings over her and take her as his wife, and he will give her rest. He promises this thing that she's calling for, this suggestion of spread your wings over me, protect me, clothe me, give me rest. He says of his own volition, I will do that. So it turns out Boaz didn't need to be lured after all. He didn't need to be persuaded. He was delighted to be Ruth and Naomi's kinsman redeemer. He, as it turns out, is a relative that's a worthy man. He's a capable man who has his affairs in order, and he's a worthy man. He doesn't take advantage of Ruth. He takes her under his wings, and he gladly accepts the cost of both Ruth and Naomi. We have Naomi scheming and plotting and planning, essentially saying, if I don't do this, this isn't going to happen for me. But they needn't have worried about this at all, because Boaz's heart went out for Ruth. It went out for both of them. This echoes almost exactly the way Jesus speaks. The Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, he says, don't be anxious, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? Trying to grasp on, worried, panicky, fickle. The Gentiles seek after such things, for your heavenly Father knows what you need. He knows that you need them all, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Let go. Let go of those things. And I think a dynamic about this story that allows me to let go is that the story plays out in such a way as to tell us something profoundly comforting about God. That with our desire for rest, with our insecurity that comes through our varying circumstances, we don't have to cling onto whatever scraps that we can hold onto with our own fists, the gleanings of life, of hope and security and rest that we might find along the way. We don't have to lure God into helping us either. He isn't going to be moved by compassion, by the perfume of our good works, nor is he going to be manipulated by dressing ourselves up in our nicest coverings. You're not going to trick him. You don't have to scheme and plot to go out and get the rest that you need. He's our kinsman redeemer. He is a worthy one who delights to protect and to provide at whatever cost might come to himself. The one who calls all who labor and all who are heavy laden, that he will give them rest to the full. If we take his yoke upon us, and we learn from him, he's gentle and lowly of heart, and there we will find rest for our souls. Again, I think of Isaiah 55. Come, anyone who thirsts, come to the waters. Anyone who has money, who has no money, come buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread? Why do you labor for that which does not satisfy? Why do you clamp down trying to scheme to get these scraps of rest? Listen diligent to me and eat what is good and delight yourself in rich food. Incline your ear. Come to me. Hear that your soul may live. We don't have to trick God. You don't have to prove yourself to God. You don't have to scheme and plot and plan and live in sin because God won't help you. It's all noise and it's all a lie. You don't have to wonder if God might love you. You turn your eyes to the cross and you see it. You see him love you. You don't wonder if he might love you. You look and see that he does love you. What does he have left to give? Look and live. Know that with all the restlessness of your own heart that your Redeemer lives. Now, there might be many things that God might not give you in life. That's true. And that's another sermon. And he might not give you those things because he has timing and teaching for your good in mind, but rest is not one of those things that he delays. He promises all who come to him for rest, even though they walk through the difficult and the unknown and the unseen and the valley of the shadow of death, especially because they walk through the difficult and the unknown and the unseen. He delights to give them rest. And he gives it in full. And he gives it freely, and he gives it at this very moment. He gives it whenever you call. There is no delay for that for you. So live by faith and walk by rest.